welcome to the ADHD Manual Podcast. My name is Abby Chow. I'm a marriage and family therapist, an ADHD certified clinical services provider, and a proud ADHDer. This is a podcast for people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and those who love us, which covers pretty much everybody. Growing up with a colorful brain in a black and white world can make us feel like aliens. The manual we were given to guide us through life doesn't have any diagrams of the parts we have. I've decided to stop throwing away my parts and start throwing away this useless manual to write my own. So kick off your shoes, have a seat, and take a break from fitting yourself into a mold that's not your shape. You belong here. Allies, welcome to the ADHD planet. ADHDers, welcome home. Welcome back to the ADHD Manual Podcast. Today I have a very special guest with me. Lyric Rivera, otherwise known as the Neurodivergent Rebel, online, on Twitter, on Instagram, and the best-selling author of the book Workplace Neurodiversity Rising, and autistic ADHD non-binary person. Lyric, yeah. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. Do you want to, I know I just... listed off a lot of your stuff, but is there anything else that you'd like to say about yourself?
Yeah, thank you so much. Honored to be here. My name is Lyric, pronouns they, them. I am an autistic ADHD adult, but for me, a really big part of who I am and my identity is that I didn't know I was autistic for the first 29 years of my life when I was diagnosed, after I went through a mental and physical health crisis and burnout and just from the demands of life, because a lot of autistic people, if we don't have support, like it's really hard to, you know, go in the world because the world just isn't designed for us. And so I encountered, you know, a workplace that had obstacles that was not willing to flex and wanted me to do all of the flexing to fit into this system that just was not built to take my autistic brain into consideration. And so I got really sick and was falling apart and found out I was autistic, and then went to get help in this particular workplace and was told that the things, you know, the accommodations that legally I am was entitled to, was told in this workplace back when I didn't know how to advocate for myself as well as I do now, that it was special treatment and reserved for management and leaders. And it wouldn't be fair to give me these things that everybody else wants. And that was kind of this moment for me where it was like, I was like wasting away. I was really sick. I needed to change things. And they saw me getting sick. You know, they knew I was calling in from work. I was like 95 pounds, which is like, I'm like probably 120 now, like really not a healthy weight. And it was like, the message is really clear. Your health doesn't matter to us. You know, you're an exploitable resource. And if you can't fit yourself in to this system, like a little cog, once you're done, you're trash to us. So I just silently started looking for somewhere more inclusive and went somewhere that actually, because the owner of the organization was on the board of an autism charity I was sitting on, because I used to sit on a lot of charity boards back then. And so they knew I was autistic. And so I started doing this like, you know, trial run through them working remotely. And the difference between moving from an organization where I was the problem into an organization where it's like, okay, you know, you need to change the systems. We've never done it that way before. Instead of saying, that's the way we've always done things, they were like, okay, what do you need? Tell me how this works. Because they'd never had a remote work employee, you know, in the new company. And instead of saying, we've never done it that way, they're like, well, how would that work? And so we got to lay the groundwork for these really actual inclusive systems that were inclusive by design, like your universal design style systems. And I got to see that in action, see that it really could be possible. And so like, I got to put, you know, my trauma of being the problem, just like I had been in school and then back again in the workplace, bringing all that back up to a place where it was like, okay, we see you struggling and we're not going to treat you like the problem. And we're going to help give you the tools you need so that you can be successful. And it was just a 9-day difference from like, you know, doing administrative work to VP of marketing in the company. Because having a lot of support, it's like, I can't do work even that's far beneath my skill level if I don't have adequate support. Mm-hmm. And so just like really seeing that and my desire for that to happen for other neurodivergent people is kind of what's led me to the book and my consulting organization and everything and where I am today. And, you know, even beyond Neurodivergent Rebel, it's just, you know, it's been an evolution since it'll be 7 years ago this fall, finding out I was autistic.
Wow. Yeah, definitely. Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, and what a gift. So that was the job that you were laid off from and had to transition life-wise.
Yeah.
That must have been really hard. I get what you mean now by the dream boss is very accommodating environment.
Yeah, and it was bittersweet, but I'm really grateful for it. It happened because of COVID, because we had to shift. I was actually ironically in the middle of launching a neurodiversity initiative within this company, and then I was going to transition my VP of marketing role to an organizational change agent because I'd already automated a lot of the marketing stuff. And I was like getting ready to start a tour, like one flight a month, March through October, starting in March 2020, when everything hit the fan. And so like that didn't happen. And because we had to downsize the company, I and a few other people were laid off. And there was so much love and we cried together and all that things. It was different. It was a very human experience. And I even worked for them for a few months as a contractor because there's definitely no hard feelings. But, like in hindsight, because like me as an autistic person, I really like security. I really like what I know. I don't like the unknown. I was pushed out of the nest like a little baby bird and kind of forced to fly because there were no other jobs available in that time, like when that happened to me. And so I had no other choice. And so I had to be uncomfortable for a while to like build my consulting firm, do all the things I was about to do inside of someone else's company, even though I love them. The insecurity, I wouldn't have done it because it's so scary because it's like some months you may have no pay, you never know is when you're working on your own. But now, like I'm really grateful it happened, and my old boss and I, we still text and see each other pictures of our dogs and things. Like we're still very, very close, and I'm really grateful for it. And I said, I even thanked her. I was like, thank you so much for laying me off. I never would have done it, and I'm really grateful. And yeah, so it's just like it's been the difference between being let go and in other companies where you're just a number.
And I didn't realize that was so recent that you got laid off. Wow. Because you have such a wealth of content out there. It kind of seems like you've been doing it for, you have been doing it for many, many years in one way or another, but very incredible.
Well, the blog started when like the month after I was diagnosed. So that's been like 7 years. Mm-hmm. And it was a way for me to process that diagnosis. And also because the person who diagnosed me gave me a list of books by autistic people, and then I'm hyperlexic, so I read super fast. I digested those, and then autism became my special interest, hyper focus, whatever they call it. I'm obsessed with it, and neurodiversity, like it hasn't stopped since like I was diagnosed. And so I was so like obsessed, I needed to know more. And when I went to the internet and I googled like autism, it was really gloom and doom. It was all about kids. It was like for parents or parent stories, and it was like nothing like the books by other autistic adults that I have related to. And so I was trying to find other autistic stories and trying to connect with other autistic voices. And so it like a lot of it actually started through Twitter, like looking through the actually autistic hashtag and like reading autistic stories, because like I was thirsty to hear firsthand experiences of other autistic and now even other neurodivergent people, because like that I didn't really understand I was ADHD, even though that had been suggested to me like my whole life. It's like not really a shock when I finally like admitted it. And it wasn't a shock to people who knew me as much as the autism, because I think people know ADHD more. Mm-hmm. But so like all of that, it was like going through that process of like, what does this even mean? So it was like, I was a very different person when I started this blog. And so it was more of a blog back then. And I was still like working in that company that wasn't good for me. And then it was like the whole process of moving out of that company, moving to an inclusive company, going to on my own has been like, my readers have been along with me on that entire roller coaster over the years, which I think is really cool, because like some of them have really been there since the beginning, and like they remember like all of that. And that was before I even came out non-binary. Like all of that's been on the journey. So it's been a wild ride, and I hope I continue growing, and becoming better than I am today. Tomorrow is really the goal.
Yeah, definitely. That's funny. That's kind of how mine started as well. I started the website just to process my own diagnosis. Yeah. Here we are.
External processing.
Exactly. Yeah, and very cool. And definitely one of the biggest things that I connect with you on is, you know, just the process of being diagnosed neurodivergent in any flavor as a, as an adult. It's such a very unique experience. And you're right. I, at least at the time, I think there's more out there now, but at the time that I was diagnosed, there was a real dearth of, you know, other people talking about that experience. So, and I really want to thank you because a couple weeks ago, for this podcast, I did an episode about like a meltdown I was having and just how I just figured like I really didn't want to record an episode and I was kind of losing it. But I thought about your video from a month or so ago about, you know, coming down from a meltdown, and that really enriched me and validated me. And just knowing how important that was for me to see, I thought that I should do something similar. So thank you. Yeah, that whole like being adult and like, you know, there's so much shame around like, you know, feeling that kind of meltdown so as an adult. Yeah. So thank
you. So much. And it's, believe it or not, like that video was like, it was one of those love it or hate it kind of videos. Like most of the reaction, it was overwhelmingly positive. And like, exactly like you, it was like, I needed to see this because most other neurodivergent adults who experience these kinds of overwhelm, whether they're emotional, sensory, you know, meltdowns, whatever, where you're just like overloaded and it's like a neurological event, you can't help it. And we're stuck alone in this like shame of it. And it's like, we shouldn't have to be ashamed. And even like that video, it's like people, like there were the, like a few people and I blocked it. They're like, you know, you're faking. Oh, you're just looking for attention. Like, why would you even post something like this? And oh, you're acting. And it was like, you know, those were the few. They're gone. Like, I'm like, I don't have time for you. But it was like, there were so many people that were just like, I needed to see this, you know? And so and it's like, those are the same comments I've heard when people like I've had meltdowns. People are like, you're being dramatic. You know, you hear that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It really triggers a very deep seated wounds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But the internet now, you know, almost 7 years on the internet, it'll be 7 years this fall. Like I'm numb to the people on the internet who are bitter and nasty at this point. Because, you know, I don't know them and I know they're just hurting and want to lash out at something and it makes them feel good to be an A. But, you know, I don't take it personally anymore. But when I first joined the internet, I was really sensitive and it was like, why are people so mean? I don't understand. Like I was all a lot more like sensitive, like took things personally. And now I'm just like, you know, you're a jerk. And it's like an amplified version of what you'd experience in the real world, which is unfortunate. But you know, people just feel emboldened when they have a keyboard and they don't have to see you as a person.
Yes,
just kind of sad.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely one of the risks. So I'm sorry, I could talk to you all day. But I invited you here because it is Pride. Happy Pride, by the way.
Happy Pride.
And I am, I try to do like every Pride, just thinking about the intersection between neurodivergence and queerness and how that's spelled out for me and how I just feel like there's so, it's such a rich overlap, especially considering that it's so prevalent and that, you know, neurodivergence is so prevalent among queer people. So, and I was, one of the reasons why I reached out to you right away is because I saw your article about, I think it was just about that intersection, right? Just something about being queer and neurodivergent or, something along those lines. And I was really fascinated by a lot of the points that you brought up, and you mentioned studies that have talked about like, studying the prevalence of, was it queer in general or was it more like gender expansive or gender?
Well, there's a bunch of studies in all the different things. So like they've studied autistic people the most and they know like autistic people are more like 3 to 6 times as likely to be trans. They've already just like looked at that data. And they've also looked at the other data that was like, in addition, we're also more likely to be either asexual or not identify as heterosexual. So that's autistic people because, you know, we've been studied the most because they kind of noticed it first. And I mean, I was like, of course, because it was the first thing I noticed like almost 7 years ago when I joined the community. I was like, for once, the cis straight people are not the majority here. I'm like, this is kind of funny. Yeah. So like, I was so excited when the research finally caught up. I just want to say, because like, yes. Finally, I have data to back this up, because we've kind of all been like, of course.
Yeah. And so, especially because like the community talking online is so much not who is the loudest in terms of like, you know, studies, researchers, neurodivergent, like experts are like not the ones who are the majority of the community. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there've been other studies that are like just breaking down that just like they looked at like schizophrenia and a bunch of other conditions. And like those were more likely to identify as queer of different things. So I was like, this is so fascinating, but I hated how a lot of the research is still, like you were saying, it's not the neurodivergent researchers doing it. So the language is so pathological and so negative. And then the other thing is like, we've already seen like with any research on trans rights lately, that have been people who are intent on misquoting and twisting things, misrepresenting things as like these alternative facts that aren't even there. Like even like if it's contrary to what the actual study says, they'll just like twist it to like make something up. And so like we've seen like with autistic people, when they had like, I think it was Missouri, that bill, that, and there was another state too that tried to have a bill. It was like these conditions, like if you have anxiety, depression, or you're autistic or bipolar, you have to they have to be resolved before you can access gender affirming care, even as an adult.
So resolving like, autism is such a funny idea to me.
Yeah. And so the recommendation for that, if you read the sup note, is actually like basically conversion therapy. Because they said, so the other thing is about this, if it's like not just autism, because autistic people, like we're more likely to be trans, like they've switched out that data and ignored the fact that we're just more likely to be trans. Mm-hmm. And then they've looked at, you know, other groups with like say anxiety and depression, right? This is more problematic because you have trans people who, you know, the medical condition, gender dysphoria, when they are experiencing that, the side effects of gender dysphoria are anxiety and depression, right? And so you're experiencing this dysphoria from having an incongruence, and the treatment for that, the antidote, is transition.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so saying you have to have no anxiety or depression to get transition, when like transition is like basically the medicinal like solution to the anxiety and depression that comes from gender dysphoria.
Yeah.
It's like a chicken and egg problem. So you're basically, and then adding autism on top of that, you're like excluding basically all trans adults you can from accessing care, because they pretty much make you like prove that you have distress to get care anyway. So you have to have distress. You have to have anxiety and depression. Yeah. You can't get care. So
backwards.
It's like really sneaky. And so they're like, oh no, it's not an adult care ban, but like really it was. And I think this one got overturned in like Missouri, but you know, I'm sure it'll come back. And then like in Florida, they've been real sneaky. And so they've used it and they've done like, oh, most of the nurse practitioners were providing care. So now they're like, no more for nurse practitioners can provide care.
Wow.
So like they're sneaky. And so it's really scary because a lot of this is because they've used research and twisted it, you know, and misrepresented things.
Definitely. And that's one of the big pitfalls of like neurodivergent and especially autism research, right? Is that like, yes, I mean, we're not saying that you shouldn't research autism. It's just like, you know, you just have to be so careful with, you know, what you research and how, and that it's being led by the things we want to actually know, right? So, yeah.
And that's the thing that always scares me, is like they spend a lot of time and effort like why are some autistic people queer, why do neurodivergent people exist, why do queer people exist, and it's like, hey, like stop worrying about why we exist and let's think about like, hey, we're actually here, like what do we do about that, like we're here and we're telling you what it's like to live our lives, like stop studying us and listen to us. It would be just much more helpful and productive. But we've had like, you know, these groups of people making decisions about us without us, whether we're autistic or neurodivergent or, you know, queer, like it's like, hey, we should have the seats and the microphones at the table to make decisions that involve our lives.
Yeah, definitely. In the spirit of nothing about us without us, like actually, like one of my favorite things to do is wildly speculate about why we exist, which just like, I feel like I love thinking about it, but if, you know, a neurotypical straight person were to consider it, I would shut them down immediately. But since it's just us here, you brought up one thing in your article that I was so fascinated by, and I actually had never really considered, which is that, like, you actually posited that maybe autistic people are simply more likely to identify as queer, as opposed to, like, maybe there are more queer people in kind of like neurotypical spaces, but they don't maybe have the same, I don't know, they're more limited by, you know, societal norms or pressures that we have already kind of already tried and failed to beat. So would you talk a little bit more about that and what you think about that kind of aspect?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's, you know, as an autistic person, like, by definition, I am kind of in opposition to social constructs. And it's not that I don't understand them. I understand. And logically, I go, this doesn't even make sense to me. So no thanks. Like, you know, that's how it is to me. Like, whether it's time or like gender or that I should only be attracted to, or that there should be an opposite sex and I should only be attracted to, you know, like all of that. I'm like, why? Monogamy doesn't make sense. Even as a kid. So being like 11 and 12, me like, I don't believe in just having one partner. And like, that's so cool. Taboo, you know, but my brain naturally was like, I don't understand why you can only have one partner, like, for the rest of your life. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, my brain has just always been very questioning. And as a person, like, one of my first words was why, much to the annoyance of all the adults and authority figures around me. And it's not because I'm trying to be stubborn or difficult. I'm genuinely curious, and I need to understand in order to, like, do anything. And since these social constructs, literally, you cannot give me enough whys to make them make sense to me, like, I can't put them on myself because they don't make sense. And like, being non-binary, I didn't come out for a while only because I didn't have a language to express it. And so I was like, I knew I don't feel like a woman. And I always was like, I'm kind of a trans adjacent person because I didn't have a language to explain non-binary because I only ever knew trans binary people. And then once I found non-binary, I was like, oh, there it is. You know, and then it was like no more desire to, like I couldn't go along with anything I didn't believe anymore. But then at the same time, the other part of that you mentioned is, you know, one, I think we question things a lot. And then at the same time, autistic people, not just neurodivergents, but autistics, we often don't bow to social and peer pressure the same way. We don't feel peer pressure the same way. We don't care as much about what other people think a lot of times, unless we are really forced to care what other people think, which that can happen too, because society is really traumatizing to us. Then we can learn to be people pleasing. And that's what happened to me. And it really broke me because it wasn't natural to me. And so, like, you know, if we are struggling to blend in, whether we're autistic, or ADHD or whatever, we don't blend in already. We're already outcasts, right? Mm-hmm. So how is admitting we're queer going to make us an outcast when we're already outcasts? Whereas, like, neurotypical people who are, you know, if neurotypical really even exists, because there's so many ways our brains can diverge, whether we're born with it or something we inherit in life, like, the people who are closest to norm and closest to that blending in, they don't want to fall outside of that norm. They don't want to do anything because they're passing as normal.
Yeah. So dangerous.
I've never passed as normal. You know, even when I was a little kid, when nobody like knew I was autistic, I had other nicknames like weirdo, twitchy, witchy, like all of these mean things other kids would call me because they knew I was different even without knowing what it was. And I knew I was different even without knowing what it was because I knew how I was treated by kids and like teachers and authority figures. So, you know, there's still that stigma there, whether it's named or not.
I love that idea. I mean, it's so fascinating to me because I actually came out as queer before I was diagnosed. It's so interesting for me to hear about other experiences about people who are diagnosed and then came out. And it totally makes sense that one would follow the other, like you mentioned, like and described. Mm-hmm. The already, you know, being outside the norm and just, you know, considering how else do I fall outside the norm? And for me, it was kind of a similar experience, but the reverse. You know, I was kind of already queer and I was already out here and I was like, you know, like I started to realize that, you know, there are parts of my life that were still difficult, even if I felt freer, you know, to be myself. So like, yeah, it was just, it's so interesting for me to hear about other experiences. And I know for me, at least, I've talked about before about how I do think I would have come out sooner if I had been diagnosed sooner. Just because there was a lot of things I was doing to cope that, you know, were just, you know, antithetical to what I really wanted. And I was also very used to like tamping down my own desires and, and needs. So, that's very interesting. Could you talk a little bit about your experience about being not only diagnosed, but, very, like visibly diagnosed and then coming out as non-binary? What was that process like for you?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, luckily, like I didn't have much of an internet persona before I found out I was autistic. But like when I like started the blog, like right around there, I, you know, was going through that process, as I said, like trying to understand like what that meant for me. And so part of that process for me was like, as you said, like I was toning down my like my weaknesses, like hiding all my weaknesses. I wasn't getting help for anything when I needed help, not asking for help, acting like everything's fine all the time, even when I was really uncomfortable, really not okay, hiding, running to cry alone in the bathroom at work to have all these meltdowns. So nobody knew I was falling apart. I was sick. I was wasting away. I was having seizures. I was just really not okay. And so I found out I was autistic. And so I realized that all the parts of me I had been like hiding and toning down, not just my weaknesses, but also even like my joy and my excitement, like everything I've been toning down and hiding was neurodivergence. Mm-hmm. And I was like, crap. It was like this oh no moment. And I had to start asking myself, like I realized I wasn't taking care of my needs. I often was so disconnected from them. I didn't know what they were. I'd like completely just like tune out of my body. So I didn't know what I was feeling because I was just like so busy worried about what other people was feeling, because I was trying to like be this person I thought my employer needed to be who I thought everyone like around me needed to be, like, you know, all of these expectations. I had just been living this life that was expected of me, not a life I wanted to have. And the weight of it was really crushing me. And then it was like not taking care of any of my needs along the way at the same time. And so like realizing that, it was like, I realized I had to start evaluating like the choices I was making, if they were choices I was making because I really wanted to do these things, or if it was something I wanted to do because I thought it was expected of me.
Oh, that's hard. Yeah. I still do that every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's always a process. But so much of what I was doing, most of what I was doing back then, was probably because it was expected of me, not because it was what I wanted to do. And even that like came down to like, eventually I started questioning like the gender presentation I was putting on and like how much of this was performative because I thought it was expected of society. And so it was like this gender piece was just like staring me in the face because I was like, this doesn't feel authentic. Mm-hmm. And I kept having to sit with like looking at me like, this doesn't feel authentic. Like something's not like, I feel like I'm lying to myself here. And I didn't have the language to explain why. And then like, you know, I stumbled across like queer TikTok, and I finally gave into TikTok in 2020 when I was laid off my job and found other non-binary and gender fluid people. And then like, once I saw them talking about their experience, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the thing. Like my whole life, this is a thing, and there's people and there's words. And like, I was like, this is the piece. And so it was like that questioning, finding out I was neurodivergent and like trying to like figure out who I was authentically and what my needs were authentically, and just like really questioning like how much of my life was performative, is what led me to coming out non-binary. And, you know, before that, I knew it was queer. I knew it was attracted to people regardless of gender. I knew it was not polyamorous. Like I knew those things. It was like I had found language for those things, you know, earlier in life or whatever. Well, you know, I didn't have a language for polyamory, but you know, I just kind of knew. I was like, it was just so core to who I am. I'd already expressed like, this is just, I'm always gonna be this way. I'm glad to know like there is a word for it now, because before people were just like, you're just SLUT, you know, just like no, you know. Yeah. But like now there's not shame around it because I know more about it. Like not having a language creates a lot of shame.
Yes.
And so now I don't have shame. So it's like when I was in the closet, even when I didn't know what I was in the closet for, it was like, there's just shame and safety, but I didn't feel safe. So I had to create an environment where I could be safe to, you know, do all that and be okay with the fact that coming out, whether it's neurodivergent, autistic, queer, non-binary, whatever, polyamorous, you're losing people and it has to be okay.
Yeah.
And that was the interesting thing, is like going out through that experience, coming out autistic, ADHD, or coming out queer, it was a very similar experience regardless. Yes. Mm-hmm. Like very, very similar, which is kind of funny considering the intersections are so common.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Oh my God, so many gems there. I don't know where to start. I loved it all so much. I loved how you said that, like, it felt like you were lying to yourself, especially knowing that how big of a stickler neurodivergent people are for lying in general. Like, all of dishonesty just feels like a giant thorn, you know? It just feels so gross.
Yeah,
that's such a good point. So it sounds like maybe you did understand some aspects of your queer identity before you were diagnosed. Is that right then?
Yeah, yeah. It was just that gender piece that I hadn't really investigated yet, you know, in life. And the neurodivergent piece, I hadn't been forced to investigate because I, like many people, like only did the things I was good at and avoided all my weaknesses. So it made me look like I was artificially really great at everything. And really, I'm not a well-rounded person at all. And so I had to do a bunch of my weaknesses all at once. And all of a sudden, I was like exposed and I couldn't hide anymore. And so I fell apart. So, it was like that being forced to like come to terms with everything I'd been denying about my life all at once.
Yes, exactly. It's the thing about spiky profiles, right? Is that like, it looks great if everyone's just looking at your up spikes.
Yeah, because it's like, there's not a lot of gray in me. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm either expert at something if I've put enough time in to learn it, really good at it, or I suck at things. There's no in between. So it's either I'm good at it or I'm bad at it. I'm not just okay at things.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is unfortunate and got me in trouble in school a lot because I think they want everyone to be average.
Yeah.
As it was like,
yeah, a little bit of
average. Yeah, and it was like I was either bad or excellent, and so they really wanted me to be excellent in everything, and it was like not possible.
Yeah, definitely, especially just like having the structure in school was just not fitting. Like I would really struggle with science pretty much until like for after elementary school and on, you know, because they make science this horrible, boring thing when actually naturally, history. Now that I'm realizing, actually, I do really like science. There's a lot about it I really like. And so if it were just more room for any other aspect of it, I could have done well. But yeah, just looking at that.
Yeah. Yeah. I struggled with history as a multiracial person in the United States. I'm like, I can't deal with these history classes because it's just horrible, especially in Texas.
Oh, Texas, gosh, yeah.
Where I'm from, where I grew up in Texas, it was
my
so
condolences.
Bad. Yeah, yeah. So it was like, I could not like get my brain to be interested in the like way they taught history. Like now, like learning about all the history they weren't allowed to teach me in school. I love history.
Yes.
You know,
same.
If they could have taught real history and the truth, and it wasn't like this one-sided bias, because Christopher Columbus is the great guy history. It was like, no.
Yuck.
No, you know, but that was history growing in Texas when I was growing up. Sad to say. So, you know, I could have liked history, you know, like you said, you know, I could have liked science. And that was the thing that school did to me as a young person. I left school thinking I was incapable of learning because I did so bad with the way they taught in school. And like, as an adult, I had to realize and reteach myself to learn. And like, so I'm so grateful we have all this self-paced ways we can learn on the internet for free now, because now I'm like, oh, I'm really good at learning if I'm interested in what I'm learning at. Mm. And I get to do it my own way. And I'm not having to learn the way the teacher wants to teach me.
Yes.
And I think so many kids are broken that way. Like, cause it broke me down. It broke me, you know, and it's like those traumas, like still recovering from school. And that's why I was like, that workplace thing, like brought all of that up. I'm having all the feelings of being the problem again. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, so true. So true. Bit of a side trip. Do you have any resources about like forgotten or untold history that you like to get your your knowledge from?
Oh my gosh. Well,
sorry, that's really putting you on a spot. You can think about it.
No, it's okay. We just, my partner has headphones on, so he's not going to hear me. We just watched this really good documentary about like the history of racism in America. It was on Netflix. It was so good. I can't remember what it's called though, but it has like a white cover and there's like the flag and I think there's a shadow figure. I can't see the text. I'm visual thinker trying to pull it up and it's not a clear picture. It was really good.
Is that numbers
I think
in
that's
it?
The most recent. I don't know.
Like
I don't
six,
remember.
16 something.
I don't know. But it was really good.
The
there was something
helps.
Else we
I'll
watched.
Look for it.
Yeah. But it was a new one on Netflix and it was really good. And there was something else we watched recently and I can't remember what it was right now, but my partner and I have been watching a lot of like stuff about the colonial history and like the damage that colonialism has done to just the world in general. And
yes.
So we've been geeking out on that kind of stuff. That's kind of what we do in our off time. So yeah, all the stuff they don't want to teach you in history class, all the forbidden history, like, you know, and there's a lot out there, whether it's like YouTube or Netflix, you know, it's really interesting. Yeah. So it's like, hey, I thought I was bad at history. I thought I hated history. Yeah. And it was like, oh, look, I like history.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely part of being an adult. Realizing the lies of the children's school. I guess my last kind of question is just circling back to what you said about, let's see, where exactly what you said, but, oh, I think you said there were a lot of similarities to coming out as anything, you know, like autistic, ADHD, queer, non-binary, et cetera. And I know for me, one reason I love thinking about this intersection is because like all those aspects of my identity are inextricable from each other. Like I can't really think about being queer without also thinking about being ADHD. And like, I can't really, you know, think about being neurodivergent without also being queer. And so I'm really curious to hear your experience about like, maybe how you see those playing into each other, affecting each other. What is it like living with that, that multiple identities and how do they interact with each other?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the thing about like so many people, like I said this on Twitter recently, where people are like, I love the kid, hate the autism. And I was like, you can't do that. That's like the same thing with like being queer and saying, I love, what is it? They say, love the person, hate the sinner, whatever, you know,
yeah.
Like, no,
hate the sin, love the sinner.
Do that. Yeah. And it's like
very familiar
things that are so, so essential to, the person's like experience of the world, like, you know, being neurodivergent, whether it's autistic or ADHD or any of those things, it impacts literally how I experience the world around me, my emotional experience, how intensely I experience my emotions, the sensory experience, which is like literally my sensations, my feelings, touch, taste, like that's a lot of what's going in. And so also like autistic ADHD, that's like how fast I process information and like how intensely I focus in on things or the inability to focus on other things. Like all of that is like so key to my experience. But it's also who, like being neurodivergent is being autistic, the types of people I'm attracted to, whether it's friendships, platonic or romantic relationships, I tend to be attracted to other neurodivergent people that make more sense to me. Even when I didn't know I was neurodivergent, like the friends and people that were in my life before my diagnosis and I knew were always neurodivergent people. And even now, like I've collected other neurodivergent people, my partner's pointing over there. You know,
and, is a great way
like,
to say
it's
it.
Hard to get on with neurotypicals. Yeah. So like that kind of attraction, but very similar, like being like queer, like if you're attracted to people outside of like different genders and you're not only attracted to people of any particular gender or, you know, you're attracted to people that society says you shouldn't be attracted to. As a neurodivergent person, society says you shouldn't exist. Or you're like, like they say, oh, neurotypical is the default and you're like some other defective thing. It's like, no, like neurodiversity is like all brains. And the fact that we have this diversity is what makes it beautiful. Just like being queer, it's not something that is a bad thing. Like being cis and straight is not the default state of humanity. Like spectrums in nature, we have spectrums And binaries are artificial things that people create.
Yeah, they're not natural.
You know, nature's never binary. Sex isn't even binary. Gender is not binary. The spectrum of neurodiversity, it's not like a low to high functioning. It's like a circle mm-hmm. color wheel kind of spectrum.
Exactly.
And all of these spectrums, when you like overlay them on top of each other, they're all like, oh, you know, it's like mixing paint colors. They're all mm-hmm. blended together. And they all influence my, you know, our experiences. And then, you know, you're looking at like from the intersectionality perspective, all of these ways in which, you know, we are multiply marginalized. If we are neurodivergent, we're usually not neurodivergent in only one way. We're usually mm-hmm. multiply neurodivergent. I'm autistic. I'm ADHD and I'm hyperlexic. I was born that way. But I also experienced trauma in my life. And so I have an anxiety disorder and there's some other forms of neurodivergency. I'm not going to like list the whole cocktail. But we're usually not just neurodivergent in one way. And so like the more layers of neurodivergence we have on top of each other, like if we're queer and then we're trans on top of that, like those are more layers in which society like looks down upon you and is like, you're lesser or you're lesser. And so it's like more weights holding those people down. Like, so like someone has, you know, different complexions, darker skin than I am, they have different weights that barriers I don't face. So like being really aware that like all of these things, because of how messed up our society is, like can cause obstacles in people's lives that other people aren't experiencing. And then my partner ran in and got me the documentary. It's Who We Are, Chronicle of Racism in America.
Thank you so much.
So that's the one. So that's a good one. It was going to bother me anyway. I wasn't going to be able to let it go. But yeah, all of those layers. And you know, like racism, because it's something I don't experience, although it's something like my grandparents experienced, like it's something that I like take my time to educate myself on, just like, you know, people who are neurotypical, if such a thing exists, like, and people who are straight or cis, like allies, it's so important for our allies to learn about these things that they don't personally experience. Firsthand experience, you know, I listened to like our conversation today and like what is it like to be a human instead of listening to people that are like talking about us without us, like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if you've experienced this, but I sometimes even get pushback from within our community about this conversation, because I do feel like there are maybe other people, and this is a very broad generalization, but I feel like some people maybe who are diagnosed as children are maybe have more trauma associated with only being, you know, the neurodivergent kid, the autistic kid, the ADHD kid. And so they're still trying to like win back their humanity and have people see them outside of that. Whereas like, yeah, it's just I find that that's such an interesting, you know, discussion, among us.
Well, you know, we've all got traumas and they're different, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't think anyone's better or worse than the other. So, you know, for those, like I've got friends who knew they were autistic when they were growing up, like they had the label growing up. And like one of my best friends had ADHD label growing up. And, you know, I didn't have any of these labels until I was older. And so there were different sets of stigmas and expectations placed on the kids that had those labels. I actually, even though I didn't have the label, did spend time in special ed, which was something that you didn't often do if you didn't have the label, but I was very disruptive. So they didn't know what to do with me. So I was a bad behavior kid since I didn't have the labels. And so, you know, instead of being labeled autistic, ADHD, like those specific labels, because I was actually referred for learning disability testing in elementary school, but because I come from a family of undiagnosed neurodivergent people and everything I did was normal in the home, they're like, how dare you? You just want to label this kid and put them on drugs. Because that was when Ritalin was new back then in the 90s. And so they pushed back and they're like, no, you're not allowed to test for learning disabilities. And they're like, no. And so we didn't test me. So it's like, it could have maybe been caught back then, which is like kind of interesting, like looking by it. I even have like a copy of the letter that was given to the school. So it's kind of eerie to see these things in hindsight. But like looking at it, it was like they were trying to protect me from this label and the stigma mm-hmm. that they didn't want to follow me around for the rest of my life. But at the same time, I had other labels.
Yes.
So not knowing I was autistic meant I thought I was a neurotypical person. I held myself to neurotypical expectations and standards, and everyone around me did too. But they were standards that I could never reach. So they were out of reach. And so I thought I was just this inferior version of a neurotypical person. my labels instead of autistic and ADHD were stubborn, lazy, rebellious, difficult,
dramatic. Instead of like,
yeah, dramatic, sensitive, complains too much, whiny. And like when I got bullied and I told the teachers I was getting bullied, they were like, oh, well, if you would just act normal, the other kids wouldn't pick on you.
Ugh.
So it was like, I had like, we have different traumas, but they're still like under different names. And so like, I hate that because I also see like sometimes like late identified people are like, oh, my trauma's worse. It's like, my trauma is not worse.
Yeah, there is no worse. It's all bad.
Yeah. And so I wish we would stop trying to compete with each other.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and just like say, hey, yeah. Because I can, like, my friends who are early diagnosed, I really identified as like, I can relate to your pain and we can relate to each other's pain. And we can also like share how the pain is different. And that's part of my whole platform that I've tried to build. One of the first things that happened back when it was still mostly Twitter was I realized we have the Actually Autistic hashtag, which has helped me meet other autistic people. But it was only for autistic people to use because all the other hashtags at the time were full of non-autistic people talking about us, which is like, ugh. And so Actually Autistic was like the only thing we had. And so anytime anyone who wanted to be an ally used it, but they weren't autistic, people would jump down their throats in a really nasty way. And I was like, but we need allies. It's so important. Yeah. Like coming as a queer person into this community, I was like, no, we can't kick our allies out. And so that's why I created Asking Autistics.
Yeah.
Because I wanted us to be able to have bridges between our allies or also people who maybe might be autistic, but didn't know it yet. And were kind of questioning so they could ask autistic people questions and also other autistic people. Like, so like for me, I use Asking Autistics, like from the beginning has been a thing to like, I have a question about something and I share my personal experience. And then I get other people, hopefully who have different experiences than my own that, you know, don't relate to what I'm saying to chime in and say, hey, I do relate, or hey, I don't. And this is what it's like for me, so that we can see being autistic is not one thing. It is like every single person who's autistic, it's a different thing to every autistic person, you know, because the spectrum is not like high, low, medium. No, it's not that simple. It's this big, beautiful color wheel of sensory communication, motor control, processing and different things like that. So, you know, it's much more complicated.
Yes, definitely. And yeah, what an invaluable resource. And it's even grown and been so cool and very helpful to me, you know, like Asking Autistics, Asking ADHD, like it's been a very, and there's really, you can't put, you know, really articulate how valuable it is to just really hear someone else be like, yeah, me too. Like that's something I was missing my whole life, I feel like. So like, yeah, that alone is, you know, is really healing.
And that's the best thing, because I honestly, I don't think most people even knew that Asking Autistic was my baby, and I don't care that they know, if they know or not. It's like, I know that's all that matters, but like maybe some more people will know here, because I think there's like one other article that talks about the fact that I created it. So it's like, it's kind of like a little secret, but like, I hope this hashtag is going to continue, like, because it is independent of me. Like, and like long after I'm gone, I hope it will be something that's like a little thing I hopefully gave the community that they can have to connect with one another, because I think that's what I needed. You know, when I was first diagnosed, I needed that community. And so I've always tried to be the resource I have needed at various stages in my life. And so like, I hope it lets other autistic people create, connect with one another. Cause like so many of us are just unfortunately really, really isolated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I definitely would say that you accomplished that and more. So yeah, on behalf of the whole community, thank you so much. You're a treasure.
Oh no.
Thanks. Oh. Yeah. Any last thoughts? Anything we didn't get to? Or?
This has been a great conversation. No, thank you so much. You were very, very thorough. It was kind of fun. fun. I didn't know exactly what we were going on, but
yeah, sorry to give you much of a heads up, but you rolled with it very well. You're very right. You have many experiences that you're an old pro.
six years ago, that would have made me nervous. Now, it's all right. it was a fun chat.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. Again, Lyric Rivera, or the Neurodivergent Rebel. Can you say a little bit more about your book, where we can find it, anywhere else that you pop up?
Oh yeah, darn! I wish I didn't have it had it handy so I could like be like, here's the book. It's a beautiful purple book with a pink brain on the cover.
It is very pretty. If you send me a picture of it, I'll post it.
Oh, awesome! Yes, I can definitely do that. So, Workplace Neurodiversity Rising it's intended to be a business book to teach organizations how to be more inclusive to neurodivergent people, and it's broken out with really simple, easy to like. Jump into sections. It was originally going to be a workbook. You don't have to go in order. You can just pick something and start working on it right now. Nice. The point is, a lot of these changes are things that cost nothing to do. A lot of it's empathy, honestly.
I know, right?
Being really compassionate with your people. It's and changing the way you think about people who have, you know, different ways of going about things in the workplace. So a lot of it is really a mind shift. And so it's this helpful little guide that is based on all of the things I was teaching in organizations over the years, both in my consulting firm on my own and when I was in-house in other firms, because I realized I am only one person. And, you know, I don't want to be embedded in everyone's business. So hopefully you could take the book and start making changes right now, you know, for $12.99 or $9.99, depending on if you go on Amazon or on, you know, get the Kindle, or if you go get a paperback from barnesandnoble.com or, you know, I can send you a link afterwards so you can put it in the show that has different places you can get it. But, you can ask your local libraries. They can get it. If they don't have it, their library will get it for you because it's available to the libraries. So really, it's pretty easy to find.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Take care. And please check out their book, Workplace Neurodiversity Rising. All right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Bye, Abby.
That's all for this episode, but there is plenty more at my website, theadhdmanual.com. That's theadhdmanual.com. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit at The ADHD Manual. Do you have a question, comment, or story? Then I want to hear it. Email me at theadhdmanual@gmail.com. Very special thank you to my brother, Joe Miner, for composing this theme music. And thank you so much for listening. And remember to be kind to yourself. See you next time.